Hey friends, you're on the Unhindered Podcast with Jamin. I'm Jamin. You're listening to me. Yeah, there's no one else. It's just me. And I talk about things. And I didn't think I was going to talk about any more things after episode 300. But here we are, up to episode 302, two episodes in a row. There's some fresh enthusiasm and motivation for this, which is not to be taken for granted, either at my end or yours. And the rules of the game around anytime I podcast, anytime I speak, is Jamin, do not add to the noise. So I wouldn't dare waste your time with things that I didn't think were relevant. So I feel like I have something to say. You could be the judge of whether or not it's useful. But I imagine if you lean in, there'll be something of value for you in this content and hearing me unpack a few key ideas this week. But let me start by just sharing a little from my world as I continue on the self-permission book tour, about to hit the final leg, which is a road trip up the East Coast. So I've got stops in Newcastle, Nelson Bay, Lismore, Byron Bay, Brisbane, Gold Coast, Brisbane, and then Gympie. And I'm taking my son with me, who's off on workers' comp at the moment. So boys on tour for 8 days. It'll be a great experience, and yeah, lovely that he's able to come with. This time last year, I took him on an American road trip where I had some speaking events in the US of A, and then we got to see my brother and his family in Guatemala. So yeah, that's a nice thing to be able to include him on this, and I'm sure we'll have some fun together. But I've been very ambitious about this book, and I don't know if ambitious is the right word. It probably is somewhere in that. But I feel like, as with the insecurity project, my job is to, like your job, is to solve insecurity. So you get a ticket to the game, and then you can connect with purpose that's bigger than you and not even about you. So to me, this book, sure, I have been a channel, a vehicle for this work to come into the world. And this is the embodiment of my own experience and thinking. However, I still don't think it's about me. I still don't think it's an attempt to have my name up in lights. It feels that it would be very unkind to not give everything to share this message to those who could use it. So that's what I've devoted myself to in all kinds of interesting ways. This road trip has been a really successful idea. Just to put it out there, if you're willing to host me, I'm willing to come. And there's been some really fun events so far, and looking forward to a week more of fun events. But I did put out a message to a bunch of contacts on LinkedIn as part of my promotion strategy, and I'd love to share with you. I got lots of no responses, lots of lovely responses, some really curious responses, and one really negative response, so negative that it's hilarious, and I just have to share it with you. And A, because it's really funny, and B, because it does still relate to this idea of permission, because one of the key sets of questions in the permission book is, okay, do you have permission to be successful? Do you have permission to be rich? Do you have permission to be in a relationship? Do you have permission to be attractive? Do you have permission to speak up, to stand out, to scale up? Like, they're all strange questions to people who are ambitious, because you're like, well, yeah, I mean, that's all that I want. But just because you want it doesn't mean you have permission to get it. If those things aren't safe, then a part of you will resist. And so you might think, well, look, I'd love to write a book. I'd love to put out some ideas. Sure. But do you have permission? Because if you are going to say something in the world, especially if you're going to say something differently, not everyone will think it's wonderful. Even if it is wonderful, not everyone will think it's wonderful. Not everyone will be cheering you on. Not everyone will be singing your praises. People will be threatened, confronted, embarrassed. They'll find the need to compare themselves with you. They'll find your ideas great with their ideas. There'll be a bunch of discord that happens if you share something unique in the world, if you bring your art. So if you haven't created internal safety, then you can't, like, if your safety is dependent upon people liking you or agreeing with you, well, then of course it's not going to be safe to put out your own work, because you're not going to have that happen. You're very precariously placed if you have external strategies for that. So Let me share this message with you and then I'll tell you what happened. So here's the generic message that I sent to everyone with people's first name at the beginning. Hey, such and such, I'm wondering if you'd do me a small favor and buy a copy of my latest book, The Self-Permission Method, How to Succeed in Life Without Self-Discipline. This is not an Amazon bestseller strategy where I offer it to you for next to nothing and you buy it with no intention of reading it to boost my ranking. Instead, I'm asking you to buy it for full price and actually read it. This is the sixth book that I've written, and I've gone on record to say that I believe it to be the most important personal development book released in the last 20 years. If I'm wrong, I want you to tell me to stop being so self-deceived and to apologize for leading people astray. If I'm right, I'd love you to receive the self-permission method as a missing piece in your motivation strategy and the path towards the breakthrough you've been searching for. You can get a copy in your preferred format here. Sincere thanks, Jamin. So, look, a lot of work went into thinking about how to script that, how to write that in a way that was exactly what I wanted to say. And I really liked that message. I liked how I was in the game and clear about the game that I was playing. I get unsolicited emails, inbox messages on LinkedIn. I'm sure anyone on LinkedIn does. And so, you know, everyone's on LinkedIn to sell something. You're not there, like you're not there just to waste time. You're there to build your business. So it's kind of the expectation that, all right, give me your pitch. Tell me what you're doing. Tell me why I should be interested. That's, to me, the expectation around why anyone is on LinkedIn. So to receive people's pitch, that's pretty standard. So anyway, I sent this out and I got this response from someone who I'd met once at a conference, don't know very well, but seemed to become quick friends at a conference. So felt like there was a level of rapport and connection. So I won't use his name. They said, is this a generic bulk message? Yes or no? So I mean, straight away, I'm backed into a corner. I've only got two options. So I decide to play his game and I say yes. Yes, it is. Except for the part that says, hi, such and such. I did that specifically for you, I wrote. He says, we've met, mate. Your arrogance is shocking. Go take a mushroom trip with your tire clip and the copy of the book you wanted me to buy and go fuck yourself. Don't message me this generic shit again. Now, look, I out the other side, agreement number two in the four agreements, take nothing personally because it's not about you. So the processing of it is like, for such a strong response when, you know, the game of LinkedIn is people are doing that stuff. And I've done it with a lot of intention and heart. There's not one moment of me attacking or sending something without thought or just a really low quality, lazy group email where I haven't even included first names. So I've thought about who I'm sending it to, why I'm sending it to them. Anyway, so there's some heart that's gone into it. And to get that response back, you know, it's over the top. That's out of control. That's not an appropriate response. That's not a response that's measured. Something's going on for that guy, clearly. I've hit a nerve. I've impacted him. I've confronted with something for him. So clearly he needs a hug. Or, you know, like can someone cuddle that guy? He's going through something to talk to me like that. My goodness, you can't come back from that. That's a big statement to tell someone to go fuck themselves when they've just asked you whether you do them a favor. So sure, I came at the other end, but I can't say that it didn't take my breath away when the first time I read it. It wasn't an enjoyable response. I didn't laugh straight away. That's horrible. That's really ugly. That's unkind. I don't like that. Have I done anything to provoke that? No, I haven't. So all that to say, my end processing is, yeah, that's fine. It doesn't deter anything about me. It doesn't stop me moving forward. I don't go into my shell. I don't go, oh, well, it's too dangerous to be me in the world. I'm like, yeah, great. I have permission to keep moving forward, even when people disagree with me, even when people disagree with me to the point of telling me where to go. So part of your consideration in the things that you're trying to bring to the world and just forecasting what happens on the other side. Moving on, last week I spoke about the idea, the strange idea. It is a strange idea. I know. I don't know how you received it when I said it out loud. It's strange enough for myself to hear it, let alone you hearing it, but coaching my own daughter about her daddy issues, and I'm her daddy, clearly, because she's my daughter. So the ability to be able to separate myself enough to have a clean conversation with her. Now, when I did my coach training, there was a hard and fast rule given out by the trainer that said never, ever coach friends and family. And I adhered to that rule early on. But then it felt like a restrictive rule that I didn't think was entirely necessary. And I reframed the rule to say, look, sometimes you're the only person in your friends and family's world who can have that conversation. So you can coach anyone just as long as you are both willing and able to pay all the associated costs involved. Because there are costs involved in having those kind of conversations with people that are close to you. They're going to tell you things they've never told anyone. It's a very vulnerable space. Things change. So anyway, we both proceeded into the coaching space with our eyes open. Amity has done my coach training, so she really understands and loves the framework and, you know, really appreciates a clean conversation, even about stuff that impacts me. The fun of it is that the things that actually impact her from me are not the things I thought would impact her. So, you know, it's all a game. No one survives their childhood without developing limiting beliefs. The game is set up. Like, your childhood is going to be messy, even if you don't think it is. That's not the start of the game. The game starts with you coming into your adult life insecure. That's where the game starts. Your childhood is like just putting the chess pieces on the board. It's not starting in your childhood. You are starting confused. You're starting wounded. You're starting lost. And then you've got to see if you can work out how to get home. That's the fun of the game. So, it was just a delight and a privilege to be able to coach her and hold a clean space for her and let her sort out some stuff and understand the rules of the game. And then last week it culminated with me being able to facilitate a hero dose of psilocybin for her. So to really have the psychedelic experience. And if you've heard me talk about this before, you'll know that I'm convinced that it belongs. It's part of the grace. It's part of the provision for humans to find themselves and to move through the levels of consciousness, to start with an awareness of self and then an awareness of others and then an awareness of the world and the universe and the cosmos to find God. So my distinction is that I would never facilitate that experience for someone who hadn't done coaching, because to me the only danger is how you come into the experience. And if you come into the experience having not done the work on yourself, having still been very attached to your fears and treating them as though they are real, and to be attached to your identity, to be attached to the story you've written for yourself and to not even know it's a story, you'll go into a psychedelic experience and all that stuff will be pulled away from you, and you don't know who you are without that stuff, and so you'll be in chaos and fear, and it'll be a very, very troubling experience. But if you've processed your story, you know that it's all story anyway. If you have examined your fears and seen that they are actually works of fiction, they're not true, if you have changed your mind about what you decided was wrong with you and seen who you really are, then where is the danger? What could be dangerous about opening yourself to an experience of the cosmos facilitated through a very special substance called psilocybin? And you read anything about the history of the use of psilocybin throughout the ages, and it was always associated with transcendence, with awareness, with great leaps in consciousness for humans who are ready. So to be able to facilitate that for her at 19, and to see her have an extraordinary experience of that, a life-changing experience, and to watch her in the week after be able to keep that, a very, very special thing to have happen. And it reminded me of some of the beautiful experiences and lingering learnings, discoveries, upgrades that have happened for me after that. I've had two hero doses over the last few years. And I'll reiterate some of the key things for me just by telling you a couple of stories from this week about things I've been reading and processing. So Sam Neill, born in Ireland but lived in New Zealand, often called Australian, but most identifies as a Kiwi, listening to his autobiography on Audible very slow start, and I wasn't sure if I was going to last, but there's something very delightful about his melodic voice telling stories in quite a slow pace. He has lived an amazing life, been involved in all kinds of wonderful movies, and A Window into Someone's World is a very rare treat. So it's autobiographies are a very lovely thing to consume. My favourite kind of, my favourite genre by far. So listening to him tell stories about his life. And he told a specific story about nights, music nights with Jimmy Barnes, Mark Lazotte, who's Diesel, and Jeff Goldblum, who he calls a musical wunderkind, you know, a genius and his jazz piano. But he was just painting this picture of these incredible nights. He plays a little bit. He's musical. He can sing. He delights in music and just being with some of the world's great musicians around their fireplace or dinner table and letting them play. And just his description of those events just sounded so magical, and they were. That was how he was describing it. You could hear in his voice him being back in those lounge rooms and caught up in the rapture of how wonderful they were. And I was listening. My very first response was jealousy from a place of separation. So going, oh my God, how envious am I of you, Sam, that you have had experiences with the world's great musicians, been in their lounge rooms, in their sitting rooms, around their dinner tables, and to enjoy their art. And I haven't had that experience, so it's lucky for you and unlucky for me. Honestly, that was the very first set of processing that went through my mind. And wonderfully, it only lasted a very short time because, as with all thoughts, yeah, I love, what's his name? Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, Martin Luther, the Protestant reformer, who said, look, you can stop the birds. You can't stop the birds flying around your head, but you can stop them nesting in your hair. I.e., you'll have all kinds of crazy thoughts. So what? That doesn't mean anything. You won't be able to stop them. Who knows where thoughts come from, where they go to. You'll have some strange ones. You can stop them nesting in your hair, though. You can decide which thoughts stay. It's nice because I think the tendency is to judge ourselves for strange thinking, negative thinking, destructive thinking, judgmental thinking. No point. It's just the thoughts you agree with. They're the ones that get in your life and create havoc. So I had a thought of jealousy from a place of separation, and I processed it and went, that's just not true. And I know that's not true from my last psychedelic trip, because one of the consistent themes that happens if you do a hero dose, and if you're not familiar with that term, it just means enough psilocybin that you are on the trip. So if you have, you know, typically above 5 or 6 grams of psilocybin, it'll be as though you're on a bus ride, and that bus ride will go over the falls, and you are on that bus. You're strapped in, and wherever that bus goes for the next 3 or 4 hours, you're going with it. It is a trip. And you're on there one way or another. There's no getting off. You can't go home. Lesser doses, you might go to the edge of the falls, but then you get to go home for lunch. Hero dose, no, you're going over the edge. So one of the consistent experiences people have about hero doses is the loss of self, is you see that the self is a construct. So I had a very vivid experience of going, Jamin? Who's Jamin? Like, I could not find Jamin anywhere. And I was like, oh my goodness. And then who is the person looking for Jamin? Like, who, this self-talk, who the hell is talking to who? I am not Jamin. Jamin is a story about the life and energy in this physicality, but I'm not Jamin. I'm like, well, who the hell am I? And I got to go on this journey of finding other ways of understanding me. And I got to see myself in all my heroes. Movie stars, sports stars, musicians. I am David Beckham. I am LeBron James. I am Will Ferrell. I'm Ryan Gosling. I am Ryan Gosling. Oh, incredible. And just the joy of that, of not pretending to be them, just going, yeah, I am them and they are me, and I get to have the experiences they're experiencing because there is no separation. And so that then after I have the jealousy from a place of separation, I process and go, it's just not true. It's not true. I you watch what can happen here. On the very basic level, I have imagination. One of the wonderful things about me being human is imagination. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning, he was the Jewish psychiatrist sent to a concentration camp by the Nazis, lost, you know, everything he'd ever had, and everyone he loved has been brutally killed, and he's living in hell basically, and he still finds meaning in that place and discovers that hopelessness is the illusion of no choice, and he has choice. His Nazi captors might have more liberty, but he has more freedom, because with his imagination he can be anywhere in the world doing any single thing right now. His body, sure, might be captive here in this prison, but his mind on a beach somewhere, in a classroom somewhere, back with his wife somewhere. And there is no barriers to that. To use your imagination to take yourself on a journey and to immerse yourself in that. And so first thing I can do, I can imagine being Sam Neill listening to Mark Lazzott, who Sam calls Australia's finest guitarist, listening to him bringing his art. I can imagine what that would be like, and I can immerse myself in that imagination, knowing that it's not real, but knowing that imagination is a wonderful part of me being a human, and so in that way it is in fact very real. So I just spend the next 5 minutes imagining what it would be like to be Sam, listening to Mark, listening to Jimmy, listening to Jeff, and that is a delightful experience. And then I go even further and I go, I am Sam. There is no separation. Sam is describing an experience that he is having, and I am also having that experience too. I am Sam in that lounge room. I am listening to Mark. I am Mark playing the music. There is no separation. One of my great sources of suffering has been the illusion of separation. I am separate from the things that I want. I'm separate from being rich and famous. I desire to be the best in the world. You've heard me talk about this before. After I had this psychedelic trip, my very first experience of kind of real world, I am not me, I am others, was watching David Beckham's Netflix special and just experiencing it like a mirror. I am watching myself tell a story about being rich and famous. I am David Beckham. And I am not separate from an experience of being rich and famous. And then coming out of that going, wowee, I just had an experience of being rich and famous without any cost, because it cost him the world. If you listen and watch him talk about what it cost him to be the most famous man in the world for a period, it's a wonder that he's alive. It's a wonder that he's married. It's a wonder that he has any kind of mental health. It's a wonder that he's still connected to his children. And I'm not saying there's not wonderful things about being rich and famous, but you get a window into the cost. What it is like to be built up only to be torn down, to be built up again only to be torn down. So I got to have an experience, a visceral, physical, emotional experience of having all that I desired through David, and yet not have any of the costs. A lot of fun. Whatever that's. Yeah. Let me not imagine or assume you've had any kind of response to that, or guess what it might be like for you listening to me talk like that. You can make of that what you will, draw from it whatever intrigues you, follow your curiosity down that line as you've heard me describe that. But very important for me to share my experience. The second key thing that I heard Sam talk about was the advent of the home stereo system. I hadn't really considered the impact that would have had, and it was lovely to imagine that and to examine that shift in the home life of the average person. So Sam was, you know, he's a lover of music. He was talking about the fact that to hear music prior to, you know, the mid-1970s, you would have these gramophones or worse in your home, and they did play some kind of music, but the sound quality was so poor. And if you'd ever heard any of that music live, it was just such a horrible experience, such a cheap imitation, grated on nerves. But it was the best you had, and so it did. But then the advent of home theatre systems, home sound systems, speakers with subwoofers, you could hear bass and treble and separate the two. You could hear crisp notes playing fine melodies. Music was now in your lounge room. And Sam just talks about the wonder of that experience the first time and just feeling the music in him and reliving some of his finest live experiences of music. And then he didn't explore this, but I kept going down the rabbit hole of the you know, evolution of the music industry and particularly the sound industry. And so the Sony Walkman was invented in 1979. So you've gone from having only access to real quality music in live events, theatres or, you know, public performances, to then having speakers in your home, to then having speakers strapped to your head. And, you know, the 1980s, some people describe them as the Walkman decade. 1986, the Walkman, the word Walkman entered into the dictionary. Such a cultural phenomenon was to be able to have high quality music strapped to your head wherever you go. You have now have access to music. So back to the psychedelic trip, right? And so both experiences of being on a trip was an experience of music. And I'm sure this is why music is a very important part of the trip. It's part of the safety. It's in, if you ever read the Psychedelic Traveler's Explorer's Guide, and the instruction is, yeah, don't go into a trip without music, either trance music or classical music or meditation music, something that has a consistency to it, preferably without lyrics. The lyrics might get in the way of your experience. And so I followed instructions. And my first trip, I was listening to I had a classical playlist. And classical music, if you pay attention to it, has a real narrative theme to it, narrative quality to it, and it's often used as the score to movies, and so it takes you on a journey. There's often different parts to the melody and harmony, and it transforms. Classical music is very story-like, and so to have an experience of being, I'm not here, but I'm somehow connected to music, I was swept up in the narration of music and following along with the story. And then at the height of my experience in the first trip, I had this line pop out to me that I am the music and God is the music. And that line made sense of every single thing I could have ever thought about my life, past, present, future. I am the music and God is the music. Whatever music is, it is real. It is God. It is me. And that was such a delightful experience. And I already love music, but that just enhanced my experience of music. And I get caught up listening to music. Music is a very spiritual experience. Always has been, now even more so. In the second trip, again, a very, very powerful experience of music. But when I vanished in the second trip and I'm not here, firstly, I have an experience to go, well, I am the people that I admire. But then everything got reduced to electricity. That's all I could see. Everything was electric current. Now, you know, physics will tell you that's objectively true. All we have is energy, and energy transported is electricity. And so all I could see was electric current. And so watching music as electricity and seeing the transfer of energy through electricity, and that is how sound works. Sound is not an actual thing. Sound is not an objective reality. Sound is a vibration of air that makes its way into your eardrum. That eardrum vibrates three bones inside your skull, and then the bones transfer that pulse, that energy, that vibration, eventually into liquid, which then transforms it into a waveform, which then makes its way to your brain, and your brain receives it as a wave, and it then transforms it into an electrical signal, and then it has to interpret that electrical signal. And that's what we call sound. So just an amazing thing to deconstruct what is actually happening when you hear music. You know, familiarity is the enemy of God. It's the enemy of life. It's the enemy of presence. So easy. And the more advanced our world becomes, the more easy it is to be familiar with things that are transcendent. But if you stop and examine what is actually happening here, when I hear music, what is taking place? It is a magical experience that is mind-blowing in every sense of the word. And if that's an accurate description, that music is God, the experience of the transfer of energy from one thing to the other and what it does inside you. Music, when music hits you, the ability for it to affect every cell in your body is like nothing else. To change your mood, to change your state, to connect you with emotion, to take you into memory, to create endorphins, to change your chemistry, it is profound. When I was in Adelaide a couple of weeks ago as part of the book tour, I'm sitting in the departure lounge and there's a grand piano in the middle of the area, and you know, it's just there for anyone. And so people come and, you know, bang away at it who are not musically minded at all. Kids come and tinker on it. And every now and then someone who can play piano will come and play something beautiful. I was there for about an hour, and in that hour there were five or six musicians that just one by one appeared from nowhere, and they appeared in very surprising ways. So I watched this guy walk up. It was the first one I saw walk up to the piano. I'm like, oh, here we go. What, you know, this guy does not look like a musician. I wonder what's going to happen next. He sits down, has a look around, stretches his fingers and plays, and this melody, this beauty, and I'm just trying to deconstruct what's happening here. So he's over there, 20 meters away from me. He is pressing white keys on a box, and somehow that is vibrating air in a way that's coming through the sky and hitting my eardrum, and my eardrum is then transferring into bone, into liquid, into electricity, into my brain, and my brain is working out what it is, and then my brain transfers it to my whole body, to my heart, to my emotion. Like, I am caught up in something very magical right now. This guy over there who I don't know is changing my life. He's impacting me. I am connected to him. We are in an experience. We are caught up in something magical right now. It was spellbinding. And I looked around and I thought, wow, I wonder if everyone's having the same experience. And to my observation, very few people were having any kind of experience. People had their headphones in, people were eating McDonald's, people were watching footy, people were caught up in conversation. So I was having a transcendent experience. Anyone could have been, but most people weren't. And then this guy got off and then someone else came up. And again, I'm like, oh, this will be funny. I'm sure this guy's got a hack and not going to be able to play anything. Again, beautiful music hits me differently. And five times in a row, just musicians come up. It was a special thing. Thank you, Adelaide Airport, for the forethought to install a beautiful grand piano in your foyer. So I've said a lot of things. Let me land the plane about why I'm telling you about sound. So the evolution of sound gear in the 1970s and 80s, hearing Sam talk about the impact it had on his life, is both wonderful and terrible. Wonderful because now you have access to God in your home. You have access to beauty. You have access to life-changing, transcendent art in a very powerful, crisp way. But because you got access it into your home, and then very soon you got access to it strapped to your head, you might become so familiar with this that you treat it as though it's not even anything. It's extraordinary that you can have something around you with the ability to transform you and to completely take it for granted, to not even see it. It's just the fun of the game. So, like, I'm sitting here as a white clothes peg on my desk. I wondered how I got there, and then I didn't have to think very long because I love crinkle cut chips, and you know, sometimes I'll eat a whole bag of crinkle cut chips in a sitting. Just, they're not getting any less delicious, I'll tell you that much. Washed down, a nice lager, bit of VB. But if I get halfway through a bag of chips and I've had sufficient, then I'll have a white clothes peg just to seal the bag so the chips don't get stale. And so there's often white clothes pegs littered around the house when I've finished a bag of chips and haven't returned the peg. Anyway, there's a peg on my desk and I'm just playing with it while I'm talking to you. And then I'm just going, okay, it's just a peg, right? It's nothing. Not useless. It has some use. Obviously, I just described its use. But how easy is it to be familiar with this item and write it off as inconsequential? Or just, it is just a given that it's a part of my life. But then if I can't call it a peg, I just have to see it for what it is and be curious. Like, I didn't actually make this thing. I wouldn't know how to make it as I think about it now. There are three parts to this peg. There's a left side, a right side, two straight plastic arms connected by a brass clip. What is brass? I understand a little bit about it, but it's a combination of two metals. Does it come out of the ground as a clip? No, it comes out of the ground in a rock, and then it has to be separated from the ore. It comes in and heated up and then melted into a shape. But it's melted in such a way that it's malleable and it can bend. It can has spring-like qualities. It can hold two plastic arms together with enough tension that I can bend it with my fingers and open one end, and then it closes and holds whatever it is that I've placed in its grip. Like, there is an awful lot going on, let alone plastic. Like, what even is plastic? A little I understand about it. I think it's a byproduct of oil. I think primarily it comes as an oil product. And where does oil come from? The organic matter rotted into the earth for millions, if not billions of years, harvested, drilled, mined. And then the process of getting it out of the earth into a peg, to mass produce a peg. So easy to become familiar with what I'm holding in my hands, and yet I am holding wonder, life, energy, electricity, the cosmos I'm holding in my hands right now. My experience of God is so real and experiential right now. I every time I hop in the shower, the experience of hot water on my head, particularly if I'm cold, my body, my skin is cold before I hop in the shower, and that instant contrast of hot on cold, and the tingling experience of what happens when my whole head is under the water, warm water is falling on my head, and it's affecting every cell in my body. What is happening? How is this happening? What is water? What is heat? Who am I? How is this? How am I having this experience right now? And just getting caught up in the wonder of that experience and that feeling. And to me, that God is there. God is that experience of warm water falling on my head. That all has come out of transcendent experiences with psychedelics, to be able to see reality in a cosmic experience, to separate myself from the story I tell about these things, and to realize it is just a story. All we have is story. We grapple with meaning. We try and describe indescribable things. And the moment we describe it, great, we can touch it, but we also run the risk of then diminishing it, of suppressing it, of squashing it, of condensing it, and removing all value and life from it. Again, you can take from that what you will. Nothing or everything. But my intention was, I knew I had to share that with you. Final thing I'd like to share is from a particularly enjoyable book that I'm reading at the moment called How to Be Idle, A Manifesto for Living, Live Well, Do Nothing. I have recently come across a Tao Te Ching. Greg Bellingham introduced me to that. And to me, there's some similarities of that wisdom, ancient wisdom, which is, it's a much, I don't know if passive is the right word, I'm still a newbie to that philosophy, but it seems like an awareness to realize that everything belongs, that it's all necessary, and to be okay with it. But this book, How to Be Idle, it's a very, very different book, especially in the world we live in. It is so confronting. You look at the cover, it's him in a hammock. How to be idle, and think, oh, I'd like to be idle. I'd like to rest. I'd like to go on holidays more. I'd like to do nothing. Okay, we'll see what happens when you do nothing. See how chaotic it is to not have anything to define yourself by. Just see what it's like. See how the world responds. See how you respond. So there's all kinds of very fascinating chapters. I want to read you what I think is the most confronting chapter, just a little bit of it to wet your whistle. But let me share with you some of the chapter headings. Well, the chapter ideas. So we're talking about the wonder of sleeping in, the wonder of the hangover, the wonder of the long lunch, the nap, the ramble, first drink of the day. First, I reckon I I could speak for each of you that at some point you've heard someone suggest it's a bad thing to drink alcohol on an empty stomach. And Tom says, why is it a bad thing to drink alcohol on an empty stomach? If you drink alcohol on an empty stomach, the first drink of the day, 5 p.m., 6 p.m., the alcohol goes straight into your blood and you instantly feel it. And just the joy of feeling alcohol, the first touch of alcohol inside your system doing what it's designed to do. Why is that a bad thing? Okay. Now, these are provocative ideas, right? Because, alcohol is bad, being drunk is bad. Well, sure, maybe. Maybe it's not as bad as you think. Maybe there's a value in if it all belongs. We're caught up in a world where we are defined by what we do, and productivity and effectiveness is everything. This book is, it'll teach you how to stuff around, how to waste time, he talks about sick days. He uses the example of Lemsip. He said, 20 years ago, Lemsip was a reward you got for being sick. You got this delicious warm cup of, lemony liquid that coated your throat, and you got to be wrapped in a blanket and someone fuss over you, and having a cold was like a reward. It was excellent. You were encouraged to rest. You were encouraged to take time off. He says, you look at a Lemsip ad now, they've condensed this cup of joy into some tablets that are three times more powerful, so you don't even have to stop. And the motto now is, we'll get you back to work as soon as possible. Like, there's no time to rest. Don't worry about resting. Oh, it's hilarious. It's such a delightful book and so fascinating, so counterintuitive. But here's the most counterintuitive chapter I've come up with so far. It's a chapter about smoking, the value of smoking. So he tells his own story. When I first started smoking at the age of 14, I felt as if I'd undergone a kind of rebirth or reawakening. Discovering tobacco was like finding a secret portal, a gateway into a sophisticated garden of worldly pleasures and independent living. Smoking felt good, it looked cool, and it expressed one's urge to rebel against authority, to create one's own path through life rather than meekly following the pre-approved paths of parents and teachers. To smoke was to be free. I had also found a friend, a very good friend, possibly a friend for life. To give up would be to suffer bereavement, made doubly worse by the fact that for the rest of my life I would have to endure the sight of others enjoying the company of that lost friend. He goes on to say, the connection between lofty ideals and smoking is, I would argue, the same as the connection between lofty ideals and doing nothing. Smoking is idleness, and it is hard to be lofty when you're toiling and busy. Like angling, smoking transforms the common man into something more heroic, more complete. It makes a master of the surf. The pipe, wrote William Makepeace Thackeray, draws wisdom from the lips of the philosopher and shuts up the mouths of the foolish. It generates a style of conversation, contemplative, thoughtful, benevolent, and unaffected. He says, my favorite Oriental philosopher, Lin Yutang, was a fan of smoking. In fact, he was heroically irresponsible in this regard and tells us that he started a magazine called the Analex Fortnightly, in which I consistently tried to disprove the myth of the harmfulness of smoking. Yutang is in agreement with Thackeray on the philosophical benefits of smoking. Smoking, he wrote in 1938, brings about complete spiritual well-being, that condition of keen, imaginative perception and full, vibrant, creative energy, a condition necessary to our perfect enjoyment of a friend's conversation by the fireside, or to the creating of a real warmth in the reading of an ancient book, or to that bringing forth of a perfect cadence of words and thought from the mind that we know as authorship. He adds another piece from Lin Yutang. He says, this itself is another advantage of smoking. It annoys the great and the good, the rational, the correct, the proper, and the sensible. He says, much as I like reasonable persons, I hate completely rational beings. For that reason, I am always scared and ill at ease when I enter a house in which there are no ashtrays. The room is apt to be too clean and orderly, the cushions are apt to be in their right places, and the people are apt to be correct and unemotional. And immediately I am put on my best behaviour, which means the same thing as the most uncomfortable behaviour. Smoking actually does what great satire is supposed to do. It comforts the afflicted and afflicts the comfortable. The good hate it, The oppressed love it. George Orwell, writing of the physical hardships of being down and out in Paris and London, said, "It was tobacco that made everything tolerable. Work is what you do for others. Smoking is what you do for yourself." He says, "I don't know why the anti-smoking crusaders have never grasped the element of defiant self-nurturance that makes the habit so endearing to its victims. As if, in the American workplace, the only thing people have to call their own are the tumors they are nourishing and the spare moments they devote to feeding them." Look, take from that what you will. Obviously, he agrees with the science around the fact that cigarette smoking is a leading cause of cancer and is likely to kill you if you do it. It will shorten your life. And yet, what if a shortened life is not necessarily the worst thing to ever happen to a person? These are provocative ideas, I know, but I just love having my brain expanded. I've never smoked cigarettes. I occasionally puff on a cigar. I don't think I'm going to take it up anytime soon, but just what if it all belongs? What if there's a value in everything? The sanitized life, the goody two shoes, the playing by the rules. So you extend your life. For what purpose? Is avoiding death the only great pursuit? I don't know who it said, but who said it, but the quote comes to mind: every man dies, but very few actually live. Anyway, it's a fascinating book. You might be completely offended or find that irrelevant. You might find this whole episode irrelevant. But anyway, you're listening to my podcast and you don't have to. No one's paying you to be here. So I'll say whatever I feel is relevant and useful and I'll continue to do that. Now, let me wrap up with this offer. You might have seen the survey I sent out on email if you're on my list. But I'm offering a free weekly coaching email with a question. If that would be valuable to you, let me know. Respond to the survey. You get added to a list. You can unsubscribe at any point. It's just a chance to keep these questions, these themes front of mind, to keep you in a contemplative, curious state where you're reflecting on how your life is structured and how you could optimize it. I'll leave it there for this week and speak to you again sometime soon.